listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-GM,
Miguel.
And it is episode 165, which we're recording on the 11th of October, 2023. Man, Miguel, the last bunch of episodes that I done, or at least the last couple, I've been focusing a lot on this big combat that I did with these drow and stuff. And, you know, it was the sort of thing where I was like, I don't know how much of this combat is going to be worth listening to, especially just me sort of like recounting what happened in it. You know, so-and-so takes a move, so-and-so does this attack, gets that much damage, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I say that now, but, you know, I've been watching Dimension 20 lately, and every second episode of that is like just a bunch of people around a table maneuvering miniatures and talking about how much damage they did or what role they got or whatever, you know. So obviously there's an audience for it. But all this to say, I sort of was like, oh, let's sort of skip past some of this extra combat just because it's really big. And then we roll up, and then next thing we got is a combat followed by another combat.
Fights upon fights. Remind me again sort of where in the act and where in... This has all been part of sort of one op, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah, one right? Operation Failing Moon.
Yeah, so where are we in that op and where are we in the act?
So, to refresh, this operation, the main goal here is that they are going to launch an attack on Ashgrain Outpost, which is, as I've repeatedly called it this, the slave-driven industrial breadbasket of Agaloc. And so it's basically, it's where all the labor gets done and where all the industry has been focused. And I've shown before this like miserable image of like a huge sort of pit mine that's devoured part of forest. So this operation, the thing is to launch a big assault on Ashgrain Outpost. But the first part of it for the players was going in ahead of the army, going into the forest and trying to gather up whatever allies they could find to help in this big final attack on Ashgrain Outpost. That has generally been done. All the allies have been gathered up now that they are going to get, including the ally that they didn't get and instead ended up having a big fight with. But now the challenge is getting back to the army, which is in place, sort of like in position to attack Ashgrain Outpost. And they have sort of a route that allows them to make a shortcut to that army. But on the way, there are various patrols sort of outside Ashgrain Outpost that they have to watch out for and get through in order to regroup with the larger army. In terms of where this is in the act, I think that after this operation, it is a huge three-part operation, which is the attack on the Mantle, the capital of Agaloc. And then there's a big final operation that is like the big attack that culminates in the fight with Gratz.
Man, big things coming. I ask all this because this seems like way more combat than usual. So I was curious about the narrative function of these big fights, one after another, at this point in the game.
Yeah, it's definitely a thing of like, it's all been building to this, right? Like, if there has been less combat in previous operations, it has been in order to ramp up to this, like, final battle scenario, which is going to have, like, lots of really intense combat to it. Which, like, the stuff happening with the drow, that was, like, optional. Like, that wasn't even... That was a big fight that they sort of, like, got into themselves. Really, though, it's funny because I was just last night watching Dimension 20's Escape from the Blood Keep, which is a sort of parody of Lord of the Rings from the side of the villains. But man, the final battle in that had like so many guys in it. It was like really, I mean, in fairness, Dimension 20, often those seasons, Brennan Lee Mulligan will like have like six players, which is more than I want to mess around with. But at the same time, even with six players running such a huge combat as he runs at the end of that Bloodkeep one, it's like, it made me feel a bit better about maybe some of my combats. Is like, well, I haven't run anything this big. I haven't run anything with this many wargs and goblins and orcs, etc. I mean, to give you an example, so these like little, these are just little patrols that the party is running into while they attempt to go and regroup with the Draelic army. The first one, so there's the cavern shortcut that they take where they run into four Azers and a Hellhound. That's where we left off. And that one of the things in the combat is that the cavern is full of webbing, and so it's like difficult terrain to move through. It's also an interesting thing because the Hellhounds and the Azers are so fire-based, they can just burn up all the webbing. So it's difficult terrain, but for the players, but then these burning things are sort of like presenting an immediate fire hazard to them. But then after that cavern, they get through that cavern, and they also find a cool loop of black spider silk that functions as a +2 vicious sling. But then, as they come out of the cavern, they then have to sort of navigate the forest and get back to the army. And on their way, there's a bunch of patrols. The first patrol is just 3 Azer. The second patrol is 6 Azer and 3 Hellhounds. And then they get bigger. Like, eventually, the third patrol that they run into is a Fire Giant and 3 Azer. And the fourth patrol is a Fire Giant, 6 Azer, and 6 Hellhounds.
And they just fight these one after another?
No. This is the thing, is that the first combat, they fought the Azers. The second combat, they fought the Azers and the Hellhounds. But then they were like, man, we've really got to, if we can, we got to stay out of these fights. Like, what we should be doing is avoiding these patrols rather than fighting them head on. Because right now, our main goal is just to get back to the army. And so, once they...
Did they catch on right away that the patrols would be progressively bigger, too?
I don't think so.
As a player, I know that would totally be my thing where I'm like, huh, the second patrol was bigger than the first one. Maybe we should stay off the path.
Yeah, and I mean, it's debatable. It's like, so is 6 Azer and 3 Hellhounds bigger than 1 Fire Giant and 3 Azer? Because the second patrol is like 9 things, whereas the third patrol is only 4 things, but one of them is a Fire Giant. But also, I had a cool thing just for flavor, is that I had the Fire Giants wielding these huge, I think the type of weapon it is called a Panabas, Panabas. Yeah, it's these weird curved swords that you hold with both hands. It's like, in some of these examples, it's hilt is bigger than the blade. But I had the giants carrying these giant versions of these, and what these were for was so that the giants could basically do like clear cutting with these huge blades. They can just like sweep a bunch of trees out of their way, and this is part of the way that they like make Ashgrain outposts happen in the forest, is that they have these giant clear cutters with their big hacking blades.
Lumber giants.
Yeah. But once they ran into the patrol with the Fire Giant and the 3 Azer, after having fought these Azer and Hellhounds already and been in some pretty intense fights, Jett was basically looking for ways to like help avoid the combat. One thing that they did in the first combat in the cavern was like they used smoke grenades to try and like keep the enemy sort of divided before they took them all on. Like, they managed to get the enemy kind of split up and then hit some of them with smoke grenades so that some of them didn't enter the fight right away. But then when it came time to deal with the Fire Giant and the Azers, Gent pulled out their deck of illusions. You know this one?
Ooh. I'm a big fan. Deck of Illusions is like one of my favorite D&D magic items going back to the early days of me playing D&D. My first D&D character ever was a halfling rogue who wound up with a deck of illusions, and I just thought it was the coolest damn thing.
Like, Jen asked to look through their bag of tricks, and I said, Jen, I went through your inventory briefly before the session since you'd mentioned looking in your bag of tricks. Maybe I'm not feeling terribly creative, but the only things that really jumped out at me for this scenario were the deck of illusions and your 7 smoke grenades. The thing is, you could use one or the other to distract part of the encounter so that you have to deal with less at once. But when they used the deck of illusion, the deck of illusions on the encounter with the Fire Giant, the illusion that we drew was a kobold. And this led to this sort of comical scene where, so Gent moves up as a shadow, tosses a card in between the Azers and the giant, and an illusory kobold appears. It looks at the Azer, prepares to stab one in the back, then turns cartoonishly as the Fire Giant looms behind it, then yelps and begins running full sprint in a random direction. Fortunately for you, it chooses toward the outpost, which draws the patrol away from your path somewhat. Not entirely, but enough that you can skirt this scene. And, the team sort of skirts that scene as these monsters go off chasing this illusory kobold. The kobold fully has these guys' attention. You've got nothing to worry about. And then, I say, mind you, it won't last long. You would hear some commotion of the chase, followed by a splat if it were a real kobold, but it's good enough to get you out of here without trouble. With Jet scouting and remaining invisible, you find you're able to cover a great distance now without difficulty. You suspect the Draelic forces aren't far now. Soon you'll be able to rejoin the army, which should make you significantly less vulnerable, at least for a time. However, rolling stealth as they creep further through the forest and rolling perception, once again, they find themselves in a scenario. The good news is Gent remains undetected, even though there are more hellhounds in their path that could detect them by scent despite Gent's invisibility, but that doesn't happen. So basically, this last encounter is, or the last patrol that they run into, is a Fire Giant, 6 Azer, and 6 Hellhounds. And the Hellhounds all have, like, keen smelling, so they could theoretically detect Gent in their invisibility, but they don't, luckily. However, there is a sizable patrol in the way of the party, one that is spread out and covering a pretty large area such that they'll be much harder than any previous patrol to avoid. It's like one of those police search teams that spread out over the fields and forests. Gent counts 6 Azers and at least 5 Hellhounds. And we know that it's actually 6 Hellhounds. So her count's off by 1. Hex and Connor haven't moved into the area of detection yet, but they don't have too long. Just long enough to think of a plan and enact it, maybe. So, Hex says, what do you think hellhounds eat? Can we toss them like a torch and sneak past? Gent says, better not be fried chicken. I don't have enough time to set mines as a decoy. Smoke grenades? More illusions? Maybe more smoke grenades to give us cover. God, Connor brought the
hellhounds eat flaming hot Cheetos.
Hex says, Alex says, God, Connor brought the wrong spells today, dude. Gent says, how could we know we'd be plastered by encounters? In my head, I'm thinking, like, well, you are on the outskirts of a major enemy settlement, but okay. And so Gent says, I think what Gent does is throws another card to hopefully distract some, and then head back to Connor and Hex and prepare to use smoke grenades to give us as much cover as possible. I'd say, to be honest, the deck of illusions may remain the most effective course of reaction. The illusion isn't always as weak as a kobold, and having an anomalous monster appear is enough to draw the attention of the whole patrol, no matter how spread out they are. Might also be worth spending more than one card for this, but I leave it up to you. Jen says, ooh, I can use more than one. All right, in that case, I throw three cards. And I say, all right, let's see what the illusions are before we commit to that. And Jen says, ha, 50 card pickup. And I say, dropping a little series of illusions might be what the doc ordered. For the record, you currently have 17 cards. You had 18 when you dropped the kobold. So they start by dropping one card, and I say, oh, fuck yes, a hill giant. That'll get their attention. You say, yup. Say, so you sneak in amongst the search team, toss in a card, a hill giant appears. What's next for Gent? They say, move away from the giant quickly and gauge where they will head. I say, things get pretty heated very quickly. Out of the forest, another armored fire giant with massive clear-cutting blade comes charging out at the hill giant, who meets the fire giant with an illusory great club. As a giant-sized melee breaks out in the forest, the hellhounds and Azur all close in on the one hill giant to assist the fire giant in bringing it down. The party gets to booking it once again while everyone's distracted. I say, it should be said, Gent, that your hellhound count was off by one. So in total, there are 6 Azurs here and 6 hellhounds and 1 fire giant. Gent says, I will keep an eye ahead to lead, but ask Hex to keep one on the party we're hoping to avoid. Don't want to be sandwiched between parties. Hex puts his finger through the ring of the Tiresias grenades and takes up the rear. Tiresias being a blinding grenade. Basically, it produces malice, which is a blinding gas. So they manage to avoid the battle well enough, but something goes wrong. The giants and Azurs are convinced of the gravity of their combat, but the hellhounds are truly unruly creatures, and eventually their keen senses begin to tell them something is off about this fight, such that they abandon their masters despite urgings to the contrary. Soon, the party realizes that a pack of hellhounds is pursuing their group, though their handlers remain preoccupied with an imaginary foe. And this is when Hex throws the blinding grenade behind him. You continue to retreat past the fight, dropping a gas grenade behind to deter the pursuing beasts. You manage to get most of them off your trail, but 2 continue to sprint at you through the gas. It appears they will run you down shortly. Gent says, shit, I throw another card. That is to say, now that these hellhounds are on your trail, there's no outrunning them. Smoke, flashbangs, gas, and illusions are all still options, but the hounds are clearly harder to ditch. Someone's got your back, though. A queen of clubs. An Aranyez. A badass sexy demon warrior lady. She brings the hellhounds to heel as though it were second nature. It probably is. Now, when the Azurs and giants come looking for their dogs, they may end up fighting much more than illusion. And I say, happy International Women's Day, everyone. So I guess it was International Women's Day when we played this session. But basically, so what happens is they're like, how are we going to get past this fire giant and everything? And they end up throwing down an illusory hill giant. This is another thing is like, I feel like I looked it up later and realized this is like, they shouldn't have actually gotten into a fight with the hill giant. It should have been, I think it's the way it works is like, if you hit the illusion once, then it dispels the illusion. You realize it's not real anymore. So this maybe shouldn't have been as an effective and a distraction as it was. But then I like...
Go with the rule of cool.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what's really cool here is that they use the hill giant to distract them, but then I say, like, okay, well, the giant and the Azurs are distracted, but the hellhounds actually, they smell you and they chase after you. And so they throw another card down behind them, and it just happens to be this female devil. And I rule like, well, if that shows up, that's just going to, like, she's going to just call the hellhounds to heal and get them under control immediately. And that way, if the giant and the Azur do catch up with the party, they're going to find themselves fighting the new master of these hellhounds, which is a lot more real than an illusion. At last, you see the first signs of the Draelic army. The perimeter is well scouted, so at first only a perceptive eye would detect any movement amid the trees. Upon identifying your group, however, in its mad dash towards the forest, you are met by several scouts who cover your rear while you are directed toward the heart of the Draelic force. Hex is thumbing a desperate message into his sending crystal as we run out of here. Coyote, requesting fire support close. Can you fly our jet? There are hundreds, if not thousands, of soldiers gathered in the forest here, just beyond the periphery of Ashgrain Outpost security. You notice that the soldiers largely divided into groups, which are spread out from one another throughout the immediate area, with some taking higher positions in the forest to provide overwatch for troops at lower altitudes. Hex says, actually, that might be directed at Sue. Where did we leave the jet? I say, the jets are probably at Omega Base. That said, you're no longer being tailed, and an airstrike would do quite a bit to compromise the army's fairly well-maintained position here. They say, fair. We'll keep that deus ex machina for another catastrophe. I say, Coyote would ask if you're sure. The fighters pose a significant stealth risk, and their effectiveness is limited due to the forest canopy. Hex says, yeah, we'll save it for next time. Gent says, I think people need to rest soon, at least the magic user. Say, it should also be noted they don't currently have heavy ordnance since ties between the MPOC and Mephisto thinned out. They can do strafing runs, but hellfire bombing is no longer on the table. You would be directed through the encampment by the various groups of soldiers along your path toward Morgwar's position. Along the way, you manage to spot a few Illithids moving from group to group. Morgwar is speaking to one as he is speaking in quotes to one as you approach. Morgwar nods at the Illithid before turning to address the group. Damn, you made good time. Doesn't look like it was easy, though. He looks each of you up and down. We've managed to keep it so the patrols don't let the outpost get wise to our presence here, but looking at you, I take it some patrols where it won't be reporting back in? Gent says, depends how resourceful they are. And Hex says, they may have some stories about a giant attack. Morgwar smiles. Well, I can't commend you on your assistance regarding our newfound allies. The Mind Flayers in particular have been a boon. I think I said I can't commend you, but he should say I can commend you enough. Oh, I can't commend you enough on your assistance regarding our newfound allies. The Mind Flayers in particular have been a boon. And the Hex says, Oh, yeah, right. If you guys see any undead drow, they aren't friendly, despite the rumors. And he gestures towards some clusters of troops. Something we learned with the help of your MPOC ops leading up to this. This place can be harmful to the mind, particularly if you stay in one place for too long. It's keeping the soldiers restless, but we're managing to avoid exhaustion and any hints of madness simultaneously with these Illithids performing telepathic checkups. That said, we can't ask everyone to keep up forever. Looks like you could use some kip yourselves. And, Gent says, it seems like they're gathering numbers too. Morgwar frowns. Noted. We've had drow visitors offering to assist our pathfinders when the time comes. Are they still safe? And Hex says, not if they're Aishir. And Morgwar says, they didn't seem too interested in House Allegiances. These are ex-slaves, as I understand it. I mean, you did give us a heads up. Just wanted to make sure you're still vouching for the drow who turned up. And Alex in brackets says, is that why do I feel like his name was Khal Drogo? Which is close to Khal Drogo, I guess. Which is funny, yep. Because my brother's not that into Game of Thrones, but whatever. I say, the drow you met at the waterfall were named Cog, Khan, and Rhea. Rhea was sent to assist the army in finding an underdark passage into Ashgrain Outpost. Those drow did have the name Aishir, but they weren't in with the death cultists. And Hex says, did we never learn Jada's clan? I thought we did. And I said, Jada was also Aishir. And he says, Hex says, I'll vouch for the drow who have arrived, but we should be careful with them. Something weird going on. Hex will present the three tooth necklaces he took from the death cultists. And I say, in fairness, pretty much every drow in the Deathlands would identify as House Aishir. Up until recently, Aishir would all be identified as loyal to the Nightside Eclipse, but this human supremacist slavery situation in Egglock seems to have changed things for some of them. Some to the point where they've been exploring non-Nightside Eclipse death cult options, evidently. Hex, for a quick refresher, says, isn't Chessie Aishir? Can't we make her go play matchmaker on a political scale? I say, no, Chessie is Dildira. And they say, all right. I say, wow, Chantel laughs, and I say, wow, we're blowing Chantel's mind with this deep lore. And Jen gets distracted thinking of those giants left in the forest. Morgar says, so, keeping vigilant regarding our new allies aside, anything to add regarding our situation? I have your next assignment, but I would understand if you needed time to rest up before moving on to the next objective. We're going to have to start resting here eventually, regardless of the conditions. But making good time ensures we're efficient with our brain cap rations. Connor groans, I need to sleep. Morgar nods. Hex chimes in, we know they're using Azers, Hellhounds, and Fire Giants in their forces. We also know that they're using some form of mind control to keep their slaves in check. Make sure the forces know to destroy any strange crystals that they find. Morgar says, seems they're leaning fire elemental with their security forces. That correlates with what we've encountered so far. It's likely elementals are more reliable than slaves when it comes to martial value. I'll spread the word about the crystals. We can use every advantage after all. Take your time once you've rested. There's no reason to move on to the next objective while you're still dealing with latent mental distortion while our position is secure and we have solutions. Come see me when you're certain you're ready for the next phase of this operation. Your end of it anyway. Hex says, let's catch a nap, and then I guess get our brains checked by the Illithids. Jen says, sounds like a plan. Morgar says, I don't want anyone going off half-cocked on a mission into an industrial hellscape in the middle of a cursed forest. Morgar claps Connor on the shoulder with a smile. Oh, right. That is where we broke. Connor chambers two fresh shells. Gent falls asleep and says, glad those cards were effective. Say, honestly, I think the only better result would have been getting the Irinis on the or better on the first draw. And Gent says, I'm conflicted about pulling that for just the hounds. On the other hand, they were just hounds. I say, first draw with the big group, that is. And Connor says, I've got a 9th level spell slot and a 6th level spell slot, one more channel divinity, and that's all. Hex is out of rages and action surges. It has been a long day. And I pointed out to Chantel, it's a phenomenal result because of the hounds. The hill giant will eventually die, having done no damage, being an illusion. But the Irinids will being able to control the hellhounds as their master means that the patrol is actually going to have to fight itself out now. Connor's oh right reloads is like the portrait of military fatigue. And Gent says, oh, that is a fair point that flew past me. Say, yeah, drawing a high-level fiend was a really uncanny level of luck there. And Hex says, yeah, and fitting on International Women's Day. Gent says, I do love wiggling out of things using items. And Hex says, I didn't even know there was an Irinis in the deck. I say, it's why I give you guys so many wacky items. And Gent says, now I have to make a decision about the tentacles. Meanwhile, Hex says, I just feel like my best one is Cube of Force, and it just seems, like, wildly powerful. Can't overuse it. I did consider having Connor summon two lions, a dog, and an elephant to fight the Hellhounds. We need to be able to recover them after, and it's pretty wasteful. Or it's pretty wasteful. And Gent says, yeah, not great when fleeing all the Pokemon in the tall grass. And I say, the elephant was actually used in the Stone Giant Factory, so we wouldn't be able to use that. But anyways, take care, everybody. And that was where we broke.
You say take care, everybody, at the end of your D&D sessions, too?
Yeah, sometimes.
Ah, that's like your tag on this show.
Sometimes. Sometimes I say, don't steal, it's haunted.
Yeah, sometimes you say, not me.
A lot of times I say, not me.
Do you have a favorite magic deck from D&D, Tom?
I mean, which ones are there? There's the deck of illusions, the deck of many things.
Those are definitely the most famous. Do either of those hold a special place in your heart the way the deck of illusions holds one in mine?
You know, I almost want to say the bag of beans for me feels like it fits in the same category.
Yeah, and I guess like anything that has a sort of a random effect, like I guess a Wand of Wonder would probably fit in there too.
Yeah. I don't know. I find it's hard to say that I'm fond of them because I find they're all a bit tricky for me as the DM. I think as a player,
the inevitable thorn in your side.
Not so much a thorn in my side, so much as it's just like something extra that I have to be aware of, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, somebody used that bag of beans like way back when they were in Citra Akra and like got the result that makes a pyramid with a mummy show up. And now I have to remember that there's like a mummy in a pyramid in Citra Akra that I didn't put there. Like, that's something that a player did that I have to keep in my mind way, way long term because they're not going back to Citra Akra till like the end of the game, right?
Right.
It's just a lot. It's just like, normally I can depend on my notes, but then these items, not so much the deck of illusions, but definitely the deck of many things and the bag of beans and stuff, they have a tendency to add things to the game that I didn't put there, which makes it harder for me to account for them, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Like a wish spell would also be a problem in that way.
I mean, only if the wish is something that is not, like, generally I think when someone uses a wish, it's pretty immediate and things, but it's like the idea of just introducing a campaign element that I had not accounted for and is like totally random off the wall, like making a pyramid show up out of nowhere. Like, yeah, I don't know. It's hard for me. There are items that are more predictable that I think I prefer as a DM. Like, I think that the Cube of Force is really good. And Alex really loves the Cube of Force, as he was just saying. Like, it's a really good item. And, like, it's easy. Once the character gets it and gets in the habit of using it, it's easier for me to remember how it works. It's hard to, like, there's so many different ways that a deck of many things can work that it is hard for me to remember, or it's harder for me as the DM to, like, roll with it to the fullest degree, you know?
I get what you mean, for sure. And it's funny because while I say I do like, you know, the deck of illusions, but I do, frankly, I like all of those sort of randomized effects. Magic items, I never put them in the games that I DM for that exact reason.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe I should, because now, as we're talking about them, it occurs to me that a fun way to put one in your campaign is just to make it the MacGuffin, right? It's the big magic item that the players are in a race against time to get. Something like that. That could be fun. Because then when you get it, you've sort of, you've laid a foundation where anything could happen and you, the DM, are ready for it.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I guess.
When I was young, and like in grade 6, which is when I was introduced to RPGs and D&D, I really loved a particular kind of character in media, which is the character who can break the fourth wall, like Q from Star Trek, or The Mask was a favorite of mine. Any character that had that sort of like supernatural ability to do anything. They're like omnipotent, but a trickster kind of a deal. And that is totally why I loved, and why I was immediately attracted to items like the Deck of Illusions or the Deck of Many Things. Just these things that have randomized effects. I especially loved, there was a deck of many things, I can't remember, maybe it was from second edition, like AD&D, maybe it was from there, but I remember one deck of many things list that I found where one of the effects is you draw a card and a 6-foot tap dancing banana appears for 3 rounds, and like that kind of wacky ass humor was exactly what I was into at the time, so I like these items, but I actually never put them in the in my campaigns for the reasons you have described.
Yeah, it's just like, it's funny because I don't think of there being, like, another thing that this brought to mind was, like, wild surges. And there are wild surges that can have, like, an extreme effect on the game, but nothing that is, like, or at least to my mind, nothing that is, like, a permanent fixture that would, like, a permanent fixture in the game, you know? Something that changes the game permanently and, like, leaves an effect there that I then have to account for going forward. It's almost like Alphabaz, you know? I gotta remember that there's all those frozen banana stands out in Drail.
When was the last time we even encountered one of those?
I don't think we've been to anywhere where there was a frozen banana stand. The main one I know of is near Austin. Yeah. It's funny, you were mentioning the trickster character there. If you play the game Pathfinder Wrath of the Righteous, that game has a whole thing where you pick your mythic path, and it, like, gives you, like, an extra, it's like a super class on top of your class that's, like, you are the hero, and, like, there's all these different types you can get, so you can become a demon, you can become an angel, whatever. But one of the paths is the trickster path, and in that path, you just basically become, like, Dungeons and Dragons Bugs Bunny. Like, exactly what you were talking about earlier, like, the mask.
Damn, I gotta look into this.
Man, you get, like, summon beer elemental. I feel like I've talked about this on the podcast before, even.
I mean, you probably have, Tom, but we've been doing this a long time.
Mythic path, trickster.
Summon beer elemental.
Yeah, Bear's Grace. You know, Bear's Grace is if the target of this spell fails its will saving throw, it is granted the grace of a bear, giving it a -8 penalty to dexterity.
Wait, is that a riff on the Sir Barrington?
I think it's actually a riff on, it's like normally you have Cat's Grace, which improves your dexterity,
oh, right.
But Bear's Grace just destroys your dexterity. There's Glorious Beard. Like, yeah, Trickster Mythic Spells. We got Summon Monster Zero, Bear's Grace, Fish Missile, Summon Small Beer Elemental, Breath of Money, Glorious Beard, Hallucinogenic Cloud, Invisibility Almost Greater, Summon Medium Beer Elemental, Summon Greasley Bear. That's Greasley Bear. Summon Large Beer Elemental, Microscopic Proportions, Phantasmal Healer, Reign of Halberds, Summon Greater Beer Elemental, Charm Whatever, Summon Perpetually Annoyed Wizard, Summon Elder Beer Elemental, Recreational Pit, Ray of Halberds, Summon Hog of Desolation, and Trick Fate.
Wow.
And they get access to special feats like Improved Critical, Improved Critical, Improved Critical Improved, Meta Magic, Completely Normal Spell, and Stat Focus.
This style of humor really makes me think of the Magic the Gathering unsets. You know, those ones like Magic
Unglued.
This
is something you've talked about on the podcast before.
Yeah. It's very similar style of humor, taking an existing like spell from the lore of the game and then doing something goofy with it, doing a riff on it. Well, maybe I'll play Pathfinder.
Wrath
sometime.
Of the Righteous, not Kingmaker.
Path of the Righteous, and play that, I guess. So many games to play, man.
Yeah, man, and there's so many mythic paths in that game. You might even, I mean, you probably want to be the trickster based on what you just said about the mask and all that, but.
Well, maybe. I mean, I liked that. I liked that stuff more when I was a kid, but it's definitely the reason that my that I have a soft spot for all those random decks.
Yeah, I'm not even sure I used the deck of illusions right, but hey, what are you gonna do?
I mean, it was cool. I think that's good enough.
So, what about your side of things? Unless you had any other questions for me about fighting Azers or Hellhounds?
Nah, man. I mean, you covered my questions.
Real trick with this is, I mean, like, Azer, if you hit them in melee, you take fire damage because they're on fire. And, like, the Hellhounds can breathe fire. There's a lot of fire. Although Connor has fire-resistant armor.
So, is it over to the RPG Danger Room, then?
I think so. Unless you had any more questions for me.
Nah, let's go. Da-da-da-da-dum.
Not me!
So, Tom, we have just concluded, like, a huge dive through the gates. We even had the designer of the game on the show to talk about it.
Hell
I
yeah.
think we have thoroughly covered that one. And rather than immediately dive into another complex RPG system, I thought that I'd just do like a little roundup of RPG stuff that I've found recently. It's not quite news. Like some of it, the reason I found out about it is I was reading the new articles on dicebreaker.com, and so some of it is like new, but mostly this is RPG, just like the RPG things that I found recently.
Okay, I'm excited.
All right, so do you want to start with stuff pertaining to Blades in the Dark, or would you like to learn about a system called Notorious?
Blades in the Dark! Blades in the Dark!
Alright, so we're going to talk a bit about Blades in the Dark stuff that I came across. And I figure we can also sort of use this to... I'm going to give like an overview of these things and test the waters a bit. And then if we like the sound of one of these systems, we can really dive into it and keep it going over the next episode or two or three or however long it takes.
I want to dive into all of them.
So, Blades in the Dark... I read an article that was published on September 14th, 2023 on Dicebreaker.com. Blades in the Dark makers Deathmatch Island channels Squid Game, Fortnite, and Severance in a nightmarish battle royale RPG. So Evil Hat Productions has created a new RPG, Deathmatch Island, informed by the nightmarish reality show of the Netflix hit Squid Game, mixed with the corporate dystopia of TV series Severance and the video game Control. Sounds maybe like there's a bit of like Lost in there as well, with the island being run by that weird kind of retro tech corporate thing that they do in Severance and Control. And the idea is that it's this deathmatch game. Players take on the roles of contestants chosen to compete in the titular competition across a chain of strange islands, needing to determine who they chose to form bonds with and trust, while resisting the pressure of the system around them as it attempts to turn the participants against each other. The game show and the game itself seems to be split into two phases during which the players and their characters explore the starting island, encountering fellow contestants, building up useful resources, and completing challenges put in their way. After that, a battle royale, like those seen in the likes of the movie Battle Royale and Hunger Games, and even video games like Fortnite and PUBG Battlegrounds, begins, putting the characters' bonds and survival skills to the test. So what I discovered, though, reading this, is that it's based off of a Forged in the Dark system, so like based on Blades in the Dark, called Aegon. Now, have you heard of this, Tom?
Aegon, is that the one where you're the Greek warriors?
That's right. So I was like, oh, okay, interesting. Powering Deathmatch Island's gameplay, said to be fast playing and beginner friendly, is designer Tim Denis' spin on the Paragon system used by John Harper and Sean Nittner in their delightfully dramatic mythical Greek adventure Aegon. And so I was like, Aegon, haven't heard of this. I look into it, and as you said, it's like these Greek or Roman warriors. You're a hero of ancient legend. On your way home from war, you and your companions become lost among strange islands. I guess it's like the Odyssey. The gods have set before you a series of trials so that you might prove yourselves worthy of glory and legend, overcome these trials, and the gods will allow you to return home. So I looked at the player document for Aegon, and it is pretty cool. You seem to know a bit about it. Have you like actually read up on the... how the system works?
I feel like I heard about it from the Crate and Crowbar podcast when they did their role-playing game episode. I think they talked about Aegon. Is Aegon the one where it's always the last person to go who deals the final blow?
Yes. The last... let me see here. The strife player describes the resolution in new situations. Starting with the hero player with the lowest result, each player narrates their action in the contest, describes the result, prevailing or suffering. Where is it? I mean, I believe... Oh, no, I'm looking at the battle here. Heroes face the opponent. Da, 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 da. I can't find the place in the rules, but yes, I believe you have that correct.
Yeah, it's like a system where... You find out the order that people are going to go in, and everybody except the last person has to figure out a way that the conflict plays out, and then the last person gets to finish it off.
Yes. Yeah, that appears to be correct here in the battle rules. So it uses that same idea in Deathmatch Island, except everything has been updated to a modern setting. And there's obviously just lots more PvP, and I haven't looked at the I haven't bought it at this point. I haven't bought Deathmatch Island, but I was looking at the screen grab partial character sheet that's on the Dicebreaker article, and I love the design here. It's totally got the like mod 70s graphic design feel. And Tom, I'm going to send it to you. And I think you're going to love the look of this too. Just like, check out this wicked little character sheet here. I love this.
Yeah, I like it.
You got your little loadout here with the different weapons too. I guess in Deathmatch Island, similar to Battle Royale, you have like... you get a weapon, and these are your options.
Give me a FAMAS instead of an AK-47. What are we doing?
And the the injury system. I like that they got little crosshairs on different parts of the body. So Denis' adaptation, or Denis, Tim Denis, D-E-N-E-E, Denis' adaptation of Paragon in Deathmatch Island is said to maintain its digestible approach to character traits and engaging conflict resolution, keeping each session's story a focus with minimal prep required. The game's character sheet reveals a dystopian element of gathering followers, which affect the die you used for certain tests, as well as earning you a nickname, alongside the character capabilities in skills such as social game, challenge beast, and snake mode. It seems you'll be able to suffer locational damage tracked on your sheet from a variety of weapons ranging from knives and crossbows to rocket launchers and grenades. Deathmatch Island will skydive into a backer kit campaign on October 17th, offering up digital editions of the game in PDF and Roll20 formats, as well as a hardback version of the 216-page book. An expected release date is not yet confirmed. So Deathmatch Island was what I was reading about, and I was like, okay, interesting. You know, we've talked about PvP D&D. I believe I even brought the rules for like D&D Deathmatch at some point. I think I did.
And I'm pretty sure you did.
So yeah, so here's PvP Blades in the Dark, basically. with that Control, Severance, Squid Game, Battle Royale, Lost flavor to it. Sounds pretty neat. And then, of course, out of that, I learned about Aegon, which also sounds really cool. I think I will cover this at some point on the podcast, just because, like, even the freebie player document has some really neat features, like the Vault of Heaven. The Strife player marks progress on the Vault of Heaven. Mark a star if the hero's honored or pleased that deity while on the island. So it's like a tracking sheet of playing the of pleasing the deities, and just presented as these constellations with your little ship at the bottom. Thought that was really neat. So yeah, Aegon is also something interesting to me. Oh, Tom, what do you think of both of these?
I mean, so Aegon is one that I had heard of before, and I've always kind of like, I guess, like, I'd like to see it in action, because, like, I've heard this idea of, like, you know, the sort of order of narrative action that they have going on in the conflicts, and I don't know. I guess I'd say this about both of these, is, like, I'd like to see more of how they run functionally rather than, because as it is, I'm sort of looking at it from, like, the outside in, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sort of in the same position. I really love the layout of the player kit that they offer up, Aegon offers up. You can download it at aegon-rpg.com for free. Like, even this has a lot of meat to it that I'm really intrigued by. Like the layout, I like the design, I like a lot of these ideas, but I too would probably want to see it in action before really committing to play it. And on top of that, so, you know, Deathmatch Island led me to Aegon, and that in turn led me to another Forged in the Dark game from Blades in the Dark and Aegon designer John Harper. And this is another one that is built off of the Aegon system, and it's called The Signal. Have you heard of this one?
I don't know.
2 years ago, on January 7th, 1966, an alien energy known as the Signal reached the Earth. It spreads through telecommunication systems, affecting people and technology around the globe. Its existence is not publicly known, though its strange effects have been widely reported. Players suit up and wear the badges of chamber employees, tasked with securing or destroying weird artifacts known as Signal Resonant Materials, SRMs, and intercepting those entities, terrestrial or otherwise, who would use them for their own gain. Oh, and protecting civilians caught in the collateral, when possible. So, this is another Paragon system-based game, where this one is sort of riffing on Control again, but also X-Files and SCP. So, you know, aliens, shadowy conspiracies, weird artifacts, paranormal encounters. The goal for Chamber was to attempt the most minimal hack footprint I could as an example for others to follow, to make stuff without lots of effort, Harper said on Twitter. So this is, I guess, like the sample build of something built off the Paragon system that that John Harper wanted to show off and give people a template that they can use to make their own games. And he's done it with this.
Can you link me to this?
Sure. Yeah, right here. And I mean, I like all of those things that inspired it. I mean, heck, this past spring, I did a rewatch of the entire series of the X-Files. So, you know, obviously I'm a big X-File with a PH from way back. And I think it's pretty cool. Just, I like this idea. Also, I note here that it says players 1+. So I think this might also be available as a solo RPG, something that you could play on your own.
I I mean, so what's this one called? The Signal?
Chamber.
Chamber. I was looking for The Signal. That's why I couldn't find
Sorry, yeah, I got that mixed up. The Signal is the name of the, like, the entity within the game. The game itself is called Chamber.
Yeah, this is one that I just, like, I don't know as much. Like, I look at these character sheets and I don't understand them as easily. There's no stress.
Yeah. Yeah, clearly we'll have to do a deeper dive into the Aegon system and then these little offshoots as well on future RPG Danger Rooms. But all that to say, I just thought these were some cool ideas. I like the idea of Aegon. I'm intrigued by Deathmatch Island. And similarly intrigued by Chamber, and if I can play Chamber solo, I might just have to do that. What do you think of any of these, Tom? If you were to pick one of these things that I was just talking about for us to explore, what would it be?
Probably Deathmatch Island.
Deathmatch Island, right on.
Not that I'm against, like, I don't know, Chamber looks interesting, I just... looking at the sheet, I don't have as much of an idea of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Fair. Well, speaking of solo RPGs, I've never played one. Have you played a solo RPG, Tom?
Not that I know of.
Well, I assume you would be the only person who would know.
Yeah, I just can't remember.
As you know, I've been really big into these solo card games. I got one right here. Tin Helm, and Dust Runner, and Doomsday Machine, or Doom Machine, sorry. I've been big into those solo card games, and I know that solo RPGs exist, but I've never actually really found them all that appealing. Like, when I think solo RPG, what I actually think about is those like enhanced choose your own adventure books. You know the kind that I'm talking about, right? Like I had one that was a Doctor Who book and it was choose your own adventure, but it had like dice involved too. You seen those?
No, I ain't seen those.
Oh, really? Yeah, so I don't know if they still make them, but I know they're out there. They're literally just that. They're choose your own adventure, except some of the choices are made through randomized elements like dice rolling. And I know some of them even have like a built-in character sheet. Let me, you know, I gotta find this Doctor Who one now.
I remember at one point Wizards was putting out like individual adventure path, little choose your own adventure things.
Yeah, okay, here we go. This is also great RPG room, Danger Room content. I'm gonna have to maybe do a deeper dive on these too. But yeah, these Doctor Who Find Your Fate books, a 6-book series released more or less simultaneously in the US and England in 1986. The books are fairly brief, but are notable since most of them were written by Doctor Who screenwriters. They have no formal system of rules, but they contain occasional dice rolls and brain teaser type puzzles. There are 15 different endings in the first one, 10 different endings, lots of them involving dice rolls. I guess maybe they're not like the best thing to do a deep dive on, but yeah, it was this whole series of books. And I remember I had one of these and, you know, again, as a kid, I really liked choose your own adventure books. And these were like an enhanced version of that because there were some games involved, little games and puzzles. I wonder if I can find some pages. Like, here's a... cool, people have, like, mapped out different page paths. I've never seen anybody actually take the time to map out a choose-your-own-adventure book. That's pretty funny. Anyway, I've been intrigued by solo RPGs, but I have yet to find one that really appealed to me. And part of that was because I have this built-in idea that a solo RPG is just like a choose your own adventure book. And that's all there is to it.
There was a series of Dungeons and Dragons Choose Your Own Adventure books called Endless Quests.
I mean, I can get behind that. That could be good. But this solo RPG that I found, I finally found one that really appeals to me. And it's not a choose your own adventure book. It seems like it plays kind of like all these card and dice solo games that I've been playing around with recently. And it's called Notorious. And I think you're going to like the artwork on this. It's very Star Wars inspired. It's very much like Star Wars Tales of the Bounty Hunters. Play to tell stories of the nomads, notorious bounty hunters who strike fear among the scum and villainy of the universe and follow the dubious code of the Nomads Guild. In the midst of an intergalactic war, you'll take on a lucrative contract from one of six factions. The job is simple. Bring back the target, dead or alive, no disintegrations. But your presence won't go unnoticed. Your growing reputation also attracts a series of hostiles, suspicious locals who simply don't like you, and their friends might not either, rival nomads or faction agents working against you. Survive these encounters and face off against your elusive target, finish the job and receive credits and infamy, or fail to live up to the code and face consequences. A simple but engaging solo role-playing system, just 2 6-sided dice are used to roll on tables, test for actions, and resolve combat. 2 ways to play. Fast-playing arcade mode for quick action, or a relaxed story mode for journaling fans. You basically play with dice and a notebook. 6 nomad profiles. Play as the armor, bot, assassin, brute, scoundrel, or uncanny. Random tables, planet profiles, and character generators to help inspire your story and encourage replays.
Anything about journaling, anytime it mentions journaling, I've heard that said before about journal games. That's always comes up in relation to like solo games. I think journaling like refers to like solo games.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, everything I've read, I'm going to loop back to Dicebreaker on this one. Because what put me on to Notorious is a recent article on Dicebreaker about an expansion that Notorious is getting, the Outsiders expansion. And I was like, wow, what's this? It says Mandalorian-inspired solo RPG. So I was like, oh, cool. And I love the artwork. If you look at the near the top, it's the second graphic down that has little portraits of bounty hunters. There's one that's like a mushroom man. That was the thing where I was like, oh, interesting. I'm into this. A solo RPG where I can be a mushroom, like a fungus bounty hunter. That's pretty darn cool. But let me see here. I can't find where it says it, but I had read like that journaling thing. Like you want like a little moleskin notebook to track your progress in, and then like a pair of dice and this game document. And it seems like there are these random tables, there are guides for progression. Nomads don't always shoot first. The speak reaction lets you talk plainly with locals or coax evidence out of leads. Add half your favor rounded up. If you're speaking with a lead or a target, you automatically succeed. No need to roll. And then there's a table. Things you can talk about. You talk into the locals. They hate the war and dream of its end. What small comfort can they no longer find? And how does it drive their actions? I wish this war would end so we could go back to how things were, .. So it's like creative writing mixed with a dice game, mixed with an RPG. And just the graphic design of this and the idea of it really appeals. I'm probably going to grab this one and give it a shot. And maybe even the Outsiders expansion, because what I thought was pretty cool when I was reading up on the expansion on Dicebreaker was here, where it says, those new to this solo tabletop RPG can jump right in, but both Outsiders and the original Notorious can be combined in what is called trilogy mode. Follow the travails of a single nomad across 3 epic acts and an emergent story far more potent than any one contracted target. That sounds cool to me. So what do you think of this one, Tom? Does this appeal to you? Because I'm kind of, the more I look at it, the more I'm like, I kind of want this. This looks pretty neat.
It's cool, but it's even more rules for me to figure out, right? Because this is a different system.
Yeah, but I get the impression that this is, going, like, it is going to be an easily guided system. It seems like the fact that it has an arcade, a fast playing arcade mode, tells me that this is probably designed just to be like very easily digestible so that somebody can pick it up and put it down quickly. But I don't know, man, maybe I'll pick it up and I'll report back. Another
hard to make a call for... until I get to see it in action, you know?
Yeah, true enough. But I think this is cool. Like, man, just look at this art. I like this bounty hunter. It looks like he's like a goose or something like that in a big hat.
Yeah.
This is all pretty neat. So yeah, this one's probably going it's appealing to me more and more to the point where I'm probably just going to buy it the second we clock out from recording this.
Interesting. Well then, I guess we'll be covering Notorious over the next
probably pretty
while.
Soon. Well, maybe not right away. We'll see if I can get to it immediately, but definitely in the future. And yeah, let me see. We got a bit of time left, so I'll just cover a couple more things that I stumbled across that sounded pretty cool. This is another one. You know, I fell down the rabbit hole, wound up looking at Notorious, which is designed by this guy, Jason Price. And then I went and I looked at Jason Price's Itch.io page, and he's got even more stuff on there. He's got a couple of other RPGs designed for groups, like 3 or 4 player RPGs. And then also, there are some RPGs that he collaborated on with this guy, Jack Harrison, something called Bucket of Bolts and Orbital and Artifact. So lots of cool looking games there. And then the one that stood out to me that I wanted to shout out is this one called Last Sentinels. So Last Sentinels from the creator of Notorious, Jason Price. And the setting here is Last Sentinels is a GM-less storytelling tabletop role-playing game for 3 or 4 players. So no GM, intrigues me. It focuses on one main protagonist, a gifted young civilian who escapes the besieged planet of Augur 5 on a Titanic starship with the remaining people. They must defend these survivors against overwhelming odds as a vast fleet pursues the ship through their former empire. But your protagonist is doomed. Their story will end in death or betrayal when they succumb to the intense pressures of hope, despair, scheming foes, and high-stakes mech combat. It's a mech RPG. And it sounds sort of heavily inspired by something like Evangelion, right? Where the hero is kind of doomed to die protecting their people. A unique system of spoken key phrases, story negotiation, and tragic downfall, a shared player sheet to track an evolving cast of characters and resources, roles and responsibilities based on where players sit around the table rather than a traditional GM, narrative dueling over the fate of your characters using wit, creativity, and a chart of powerful key phrases to interrupt each other's scenes and introduce offers that require tough decisions. A game timer that introduces a key enemy and raises the stakes, ensuring that death or betrayal are inevitable. One-shot rules for shorter games are to help introduce new players, and alternative campaign rules where each player takes control of their own sentinel mech, with roles rotating around the table. Last Sentinels also features mecha-themed graphic design and artwork, a narrative prologue, safety tools, examples of play, and resources to help generate and create your story and characters. You know I love a giant robot, Tom. Wait, did you know that? You must have known
that.
Yeah,
I know that.
Yeah, I love a good Pacific Rim or Evangelion or just give me... Or Symbionic Titan is an underrated one.
Yeah, do you... Did you follow an offshoot of that Last Sentinels to check out Polaris Chivalric Tragedy at Utmost North?
Not yet, but I did notice that. Are you familiar with this one?
No.
There's not a lot on the Itch.io page for it, which is why I didn't want to go into it. Like, there's a bunch of flavor text here, but really all that the Itch.io page for Polaris Chivalric Tragedy at Utmost North, all they give you is... Polaris is a unique role-playing game, often imitated but never recaptured. The entire game is framed and played through use of specific key phrases used where
it's
other
familiar
games use...
from what you were saying about Last Sentence.
Yeah, cards, dice, or ability scores. It requires no GM or centralized planning, instead dividing those responsibilities between the players. In all, the game takes about 12 to 40 hours to play to conclusion, split up in 3 to 8 nights of play. They don't even tell you, like, the optimal number of players for it. Oh, yeah, here it is. 3 to 5 players ages 14 and up. It's in the graphic. It's not actually in the info. I don't know. What do you think?
It's all interesting. It's just like, you know, we have to pick one and buckle down on it, you know? All these are like, hey, there's a game we could check out. And,
yeah, we're doing some window shopping here, but do any of these appeal to you more than the others?
No, I think Deathmatch Island is the one that's most interesting to me right now.
Okay. Well, we can work towards that one.
If you get Notorious, then I'm happy to check that out.
Well, I will get Notorious, and we'll check it out at some point. We'll figure that out. But let me talk about one more silly little RPG I stumbled across. And once again, I'm really shilling for Dicebreaker.com these days, but, you know, it's where I've been reading my game news, my non-video game news anyway. Comedy RPG Coffee and Chaos lets your D&D characters run a cafe and uses cutlery instead of dice. Now, I thought of you, Tom, or rather I thought of your players in Coyote's Aegis.
I have heard about this.
Yeah? What have you heard?
Just that it's a game where you use cutlery instead of dice, and it's about running a coffee shop.
Do your tabletop characters want to run a cozy but hectic cafe instead of delving into yet another monster and trap-filled dungeon? Rather wrangle a broken espresso machine instead of an ornery bugbear? Save your healing spells for the customer who ate 5 croissants in 2 minutes? Comedy tabletop RPG Coffee and Chaos allows you to do all this and more in short, fun sessions meant to be slotted in between grand adventures. So this is why I thought of you, you know, it's like how you did like the little Iron Chef mini game in between operations, or, you know, the setting up the frozen banana stands and all the cooking that goes on in your game. I was like, man, they could, that party could open their own cafe, and then in between sessions, you could run little coffee and chaos games in between the major operations.
I suppose I could.
Because Coffee and Chaos is not a full setting, more a supplement, and it's printed on a cafe-style trifold menu, insider rules and resources that help your group's party of adventurers to set aside the torches and rope for a bit and don their barista aprons as they attempt to keep a coffee shop afloat for a single shift. Instead of creating new characters, Coffee and Chaos walks players through the process of translating their fantasy heroes' abilities, spell stats, and weapons into food service appropriate talents. So this is very much designed to, like, slot into your fantasy game in between sessions, and even you can even convert your existing player characters to work in this. The wizard can levitate ingredients from the top shelf. The bard can calm the rush of customers waiting for the fighters to subdue the mimic masquerading as a milk steamer. Players use a cutlery-based system of knives, forks, and spoons as resource tokens and tackle prompted obstacles as a team, such as handling a rush hour of impish demons or exhuming a ghost that's currently haunting the supply closet. Each character can approach the problem as they choose, using different cutlery tokens to represent a straightforward brute force technique or a less conventional solution that leans into the catastrophe as an unplanned opportunity. And here, if you want to take a look at sort of what this looks like in practice, there's some graphics here. Now, these graphics have pictures of cutlery on cards and tokens. Let me tell you, Tom, if I was going to run this, I would insist that we use actual cutlery.
Yeah,
wouldn't
I thought you'd say that.
You thought I'd say that? Yeah, well, you do know me. So really, this is, it says here, it's meant to prioritize hilarious storytelling over more traditional RPG goals. So it really just sounds like something fun to toss in between sessions. Maybe if a character, or rather a player, can't make it, everybody could spend a shift working in the coffee shop that they set up. And it's a creation of Cobblepath Games, consisting of designer Fern Milton and writer Steph Williamson. And it is also available on itch.io. This one, I will say, like, of all the ones I mentioned, this one just made me sort of go like, yeah, that's cute. You know, I don't know if I'm going to play it. It's cute. But it is interesting that when I came across it, I also thought, like, I immediately thought of an application for it, where if your characters wanted to set up their own little cafe, it would totally fit with what you've established.
Yeah. It's interesting to me. It makes me think, like, what if we end up at some point with all... I wonder if we have other games like this for other potential, like, businesses that people could do in Dungeons & Dragons. You know, there's the whole system in the Dungeon Master's Guide about, you know, running your own... what have you, having a castle or a fortress or what have you. I mean, we've also looked into this with, like, Wicked Ones to some extent. It's like, you know, management. It's interesting, you know, the idea that you could have a game that provides another layer to Dungeons & Dragons that you then slot in between regular games. Like, I don't know, it'd be cool to see that for all sorts of things, not just coffee shops.
Now you got me thinking, though, of slotting this into Wicked Ones, where all the players start just as baristas before deciding to strike out on their own and establish a proper dungeon.
Coffee dungeon.
Coffee. You know, goddamn. Take note, listeners. We said it here first. Coffee dungeon is a great pairing of words, and if it doesn't already exist, we gotta claim that, Tom.
Coffee, I don't know, dungeon. I already gotta write the evil version.
It's already of, it already does exist. It's already a place in Florida.
I gotta write the evil version of the gates, where a creep takes you on a terrible journey and exposes you to a bunch of sophistry.
Sure. Okay. Do that and we'll also cover it.
Okay.
Anyway, those are all the little RPGs and things that I came across since we last recorded. And I just couldn't decide. I couldn't settle on one that I wanted to cover. And I mean, obviously the answer is maybe all of them at some point. But yeah, it seems like for the most part, you think they're okay, but you want to see them in action before you actually assess whether or not they appeal to you. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know, like Aegon and things like that. The thing is that right now I feel pretty invested in Forged in the Dark. It's like I'm very much, my head is in that space. And so to get me to move to something new, I need to see more of it than just, like, you know, the boilerplate, you know?
That's totally fair. So I guess there's nothing for it but to dive a little deeper on some of this stuff. And
yeah, I'm cool with
maybe starting with Deathmatch Island, since that one held some appeal for you.
Well, that one's not out yet, is it?
Oh, no, I guess it's not. I guess that's coming out, like, maybe late next week or something. What did it say?
Easier to do...
But, you know, the thing is, that one's based on Aegon. So I could always do Aegon leading into Deathmatch Island.
Yeah, I will say about Aegon is, like, apparently Aegon, you don't just play your character. And I'm a person who prefers to just play my character, I think.
That's fair. And yes, for the record, by the time, as of this recording, Deathmatch Island comes out next week. Comes out October 17th, so... not far from now.
Damn.
And that's all I got. I'm totally going to buy Notorious.
All right. Well, while McGill does that, why don't you guys see when we post new episodes, get in touch with us, follow us on Facebook, Compare and Campaign on Facebook.com, or check out our supplemental and show our supplemental material and show notes, compareandcampaign.wordpress.com. Check all that out. Not me.
level up, get that ding if you're playing that kind of game. But otherwise, I don't know, get your target, fight your friend, appease the deities, run a coffee shop, all the above.
So much to do, man.
So much to do.
Thank you.